Great to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you have a great weekend all lined up or in process. Joining me this week to review the movies, Wade Major, film critic for Cinegods.com, and Christy Lemire, RogerEbert.com, and co-host of YouTube's What the Flick. We begin with I Feel Pretty, starring Amy Schumer. The comedy is co-written and co-directed by Abby Cohn and Mark Silverstein. Christy, what did you think of I Feel Pretty?
So this is a very high-concept, modern-day fairy tale. It's as high concept as you can get, and it has created a bit of a backlash as far as accusing the film and the filmmakers of body shaming, but I would argue it's actually quite the opposite. So Amy Schumer stars as a woman who has an okay life and an okay job, but she is just plagued by deep, deep insecurity. And she hates how she looks and she hates how she feels. And she goes to a spin class at SoulCycle, a packed, intense spin class at the Cult of SoulCycle. And she has a ghastly accident, bonks her head. And when she comes to, she believes she has the looks she's always dreamed of, the body and the face and the gorgeous bombshell appeal she's always wanted. But externally, she has not changed a bit. And that is the clever central conceit. But she begins to radiate the confidence of somebody who would look like that. And it changes her entire life. And it's actually about finding confidence from within. It's not really that complicated of a concept. It's very much a it was within you all along sort of thing. The problem I have is not about body shaming. It really celebrates her in her bodiness and her brashness. But the ending comes along and contradicts
undermines.
Yeah, it's. I don't want to give it away, but it contradicts what the whole film had been about previously. But I had a good time for a long time, and I love Michelle Williams in this.
Oh my gosh, she's
well, when's
so
she
good.
Ever not been good?
Well, this is a comic role for her. That's the difference.
Oh yeah,
it's a
yeah
rare
I don't think I've
bit
seen
of
her in a comic.
It's the first comic thing that she has done since Dick.
Oh, Dick.
When she was
funny.
Younger, a lot younger, and she's funny in Dick, but she's not this funny. She's hilarious in this. She puts this voice on, and everything is about her is just, and yet she's in. Endearing at the same time. She's not really going super broad. I really enjoyed this. I agree that the ending does undermine it a little. I think it's forgivable because that undermining is the screenwriters, the writers and directors, Abby Cohn and Mark Silverstein, who are making their directing debut here. They previously did, you know, they love this whole genre, Never Been Kissed. They wrote, you know, they've kind of been doing Valentine's Day. They've been doing a lot of romantic comedy stuff for years and years. And they feel the need to be very formulaic. So they have to go to a place that they shouldn't go to in order to make it sort of fulfill the romantic comedy formula. This thing is formulaic to the second. Mm-hmm. I kid you not. There's something that happens in the film that in most films happens kind of around the 1 hour mark. Here it doesn't just happen at the 1 hour minute. It happens at the 1 hour second to exactly the second. I couldn't believe it. I looked at my watch and I said, really, did you just time this out to just hit it right on the mark? And they do. So it is formulaic to a T, but all the performances are really engaging. Amy Schumer is wonderful. And what's charming about it is precisely that it's not the magical motif that you get in Big. She's watching Big, and then she goes and she makes a wish.
Oh, she actually is watching it in the film?
She's actually – they own it. But it's not a real magical thing that happens. It's something that is completely explainable with that old cartoon gimmick of bonking your head. And you know where it's going to go from there. You know that there's going to be the unbonking and all the formula is going to fall into place. But the thing is the message is so sincere and the characters are so endearing and the performances are just so heartfelt that it's really hard to get too critical.
I'm curious your thought. I only saw the trailer for it in the theaters. And I laughed. I mean, thought it was funny. It did seem very formulaic, as you say. One of the thoughts I had, though, is, and maybe this is dealt with because it's her fantasy, but my thought was, so she changes this way, but it didn't just seem that she had more confidence in herself. It was sort of that she was carrying herself in a way like, look how hot I am. And so I was kind of wondering, well, it's sort of is like her happiness tied up in being perceived as hot? Is it, you know, or is this just her fantasy? I wasn't quite sure how that was a message of being empowered.
Well, her happiness is definitely tied up in being hot. And then once she feels like she's hot, it opens the doors to her that had been closed. Like, she has the swagger to go after the job she wants and to flirt with a guy at the dry cleaners who ends up becoming her boyfriend. And so, yes, feeling good about herself entirely based on physicality is what gives her the inner confidence to then seize all of her dreams.
Yeah.
So it sounds cheesy and problematic, but actually it's kind of a good message. And it's also about how everybody's insecure, no matter what you look like, no matter what others' perception of you might be. Emily Ratajkowski is in this, who is held up as the beautiful ideal of physical perfection. And she, her character is insecure about other stuff. And so, it's not reinventing the wheel here.
It does walk a little bit of a line, but let's give it to Amy Schumer. Whatever apprehension you may have about some of the nuances of the message, she sells it. You know, she can sell cookies to a Girl Scout. She walks onto the screen, and she invests this character with so much heartfelt credibility that whatever reservations you may have, they just fade away because it's Amy Schumer.
Amy Schumer stars in I Feel Pretty, co-written, co-directed by Abby Cohn and Mark Silverstein. It's rated PG-13 in wide release. Also this week, the thriller Traffic with a K, starring Paula Patton and Omar Epps. Dion Taylor's the writer-director. Christy?
Yes, this is not the British series Traffic, which inspired the Soderbergh film Traffic. This is a whole other thing about sex trafficking. And it's kind of problematic because it's this grimy, exploitative B-movie, but it also has these loftier aspirations of being a really noble piece of advocacy cinema. It is about sex trafficking, but it's also a shoot 'em up with bad guys and bikers. So Paula Patton and Omar Epps co-star as boyfriend and girlfriend. They go away for the weekend to this beautiful remote house in the mountains in Northern California. On the way there, they stop at the kind of gas station that people always end up stopping at.
Have trouble there, don't they?
Right. And they run into these bikers and they inadvertently stumble upon this sex trafficking ring, but they don't know that yet. And the bikers follow them to the house and it gets ugly pretty fast. It is about a serious topic, and writer-director Dion Taylor really, really means well here in shining a light on a really disturbing subject. But also, he wants to have thrilling moments of action and gunfire and skeezy bad guys. And so it's a tough balance tonally, but it looks a lot better than a movie like this might ordinarily, because it was shot by the great cinematographer Dante Spinotti, the Oscar-nominated cinematographer of L.A. Confidential and The Insider. This is somebody who works with Michael Mann quite a bit, and he knows what he's doing, so this looks a lot better than you might think, but at its core, it does not work.
Traffic is the film. Dion Taylor, the writer-director. It's rated R in wide release. Also out this week, re-released 4K restoration of the French drama Quai des Orfèvres, Quay of the Goldsmiths, the film directed and co-written by Henri-Georges Clouzot. Wait, what'd you think of this when you saw it in 47? No, just
my favorite movie of the week. I love this film. It's just so much fun. It's a romance and a thriller all at the same time. You know, Clouzot, one of the great thriller directors, kind of a harbinger of Hitchcock, certainly from another country and culture, all of that is here. There's a murder, and there's a very Hitchcockian entanglement that enfolds this female singer, who's an up and coming singer, and her husband, who have this wonderful tempestuous relationship. They fight all the time. He's jealous as can be, and she's independent, and yet they're dedicated to each other in a ridiculous way. And then into this, you bring the detective who's trying to unravel all of what happened and who you know really killed this guy, and where were the two of you? And they're trying to protect each other, and it's almost like a murder mystery thriller romance farce, and it has all those elements in it, and it's funny, and it's engaging, and it's suspenseful, and it's so smart and well written and beautifully directed. And Bernard Blier, who plays the husband, is of course the father of the great director Bertrand Blier. So there's a generational bit of trivia too.
Christy?
So I have to admit, I had never seen this movie.
It's so fun,
and I'm so glad that I did, because yeah, you're right. It makes these tonal shifts that would seem really difficult just seem effortless. And it really subtly morphs from what you think at the beginning is going to be like a musical comedy,
yeah,
right? Because Susie Dallaire, who is the star, the music hall star, is just brash and brazen and sexy and funny, and she can work the room. And then it just gets darker and more tense, and more characters come into it that complicate things. I also want to point out this is it seems like, at the time, a rare LGBT subplot within this film.
There is, yeah.
There is an infatuation here that you might not necessarily expect within this film, but that works, too, as a piece of it. So, yeah, I was gripped the whole time.
We're talking about the French film, first released in 1947, now in a 4K digital restoration, Quai des Orfèvres, Quay of the Goldsmiths, from Henri-Georges Clouzot, who was the co-writer and director. It's unrated. You can see it on the big screen of Lemley's Royal Theater in West Los Angeles. The documentary, The Heart of Nuba, goes to Sudan, to the remote area of the Nuba Mountains, where Dr. Tom Katina is the only doctor for a couple hundred miles. Wade, what did you think of The Heart of Nuba?
I think this is such a devastatingly essential film to see. It's so hard to watch. But what the documentary crew does is praiseworthy, almost Nobel Prize praiseworthy. They go right into the middle of a war zone. This is, if anyone thinks that the conflict in Darfur went away, it didn't. It just migrated to a different part of the country. The people in the Nuba Mountains it's a very isolated area, but it's a very old culture. It's a very ancient culture. And it's a culture where people of all different faiths, Christians and animists and Muslims, all live in harmony and in peace. And unfortunately, there's the ongoing racist problem of the government by the convicted war criminal Omar al-Bashir, who believes that black Africans are inferior. And on top of that, they're sitting on top of some very wealthy mineral lands, them and their cows and their farmland, and he wants to get rid of them. He is literally trying to execute genocide against the Nuba people. And in the middle of this is a lone hospital and a lone surgeon, a Catholic hospital, and Dr. Tom Katena, who's the only physician in this hospital. And all of their medical needs have to be cared for by him alone. And his devotion to these people is extraordinary. And what he goes through. And you see bombs falling in the film in the first few seconds. It's unbelievable the level of dedication that he has for these people and the love that he has and the self-sacrifice is through the roof. It's a very hard film to watch.
But well made?
So well made. And what they do with the cameras in moments of urgency when there's a raid, they will hand him the camera. You know, the filmmakers will take shelter, and then he has the camera. And, you know, they do things to make sure that the film is done in a faithful journalistic way.
Christy, what do you think of The Heart of Nuba?
It is devastating to watch, but it's also extremely worshipful of this man. And he is a saint. He absolutely is. And I cannot imagine that kind of dedication, that kind of sacrifice. I mean, he talks about how, yeah, he gets lonely sometimes and, you know, his family would like him to settle down. It also points out his background. He was a football player. He was a star football player at Brown University. He was all Ivy League. So his background's kind of interesting, too. I would like a little more, I don't know, shading, perhaps. It's one tone in terms of how worshipful it is of him. But then again, like, he's doing amazing work. You mentioned the intimacy of the camera work. It's not just during moments of crisis and bombs falling. Like, there are surgeries where we are right there. He's having to operate on this infant girl who has kidney cancer. We're right there. We're right there when the woman's having a C-section. So he's the gynecologist and the pediatrician and everything in between. And it is gripping and hard to watch.
And does that explain how he ended up there?
He always felt like he wanted to be called to use his medical expertise as part of a community. He felt really drawn to becoming part of the fabric of a totally different kind of place.
And it's a religious imperative for him as well. I mean, it's a Catholic hospital, and he and his family, they are devout Catholics, and he feels a certain obligation to fulfill that.
The film is The Heart of Nuba, a documentary which shows what the daily life of Dr. Tom Katina is in the remote Sudanese area of the Nuba Mountains. Kenneth A. Carlson is the director. The film is unrated. You can see it at Lemley's Music Hall Theater in Beverly Hills. Not screened for critics this week, Super Troopers 2, the comedy from J. Chandrasekhar. He not only stars in the film, he directed it, he co-wrote it, and the R-rated comedy in wide release. But again, not screened for critics to tell you what they think of it. Probably has its own built-in audience. We'll be back with more reviews in a minute. A little bit later on Film Week, we're going to take a look at new guidelines released by SAG-AFTRA, the union representing actors. A part of an expansion of its code of conduct calls for an end to the practice of producers and directors holding auditions or professional meetings in private hotel rooms or residences. The guidelines saying if there's no reasonable alternative to an audition like that, members are encouraged to take a support peer for safety and support. We're going to talk with actors as well as the president of SAG-AFTRA, Gabrielle Carteris, and hear about how in practice this is expected to work and if there might be any obstacles to doing this, particularly for low-budget productions. But we continue with our critics Christy Lemire and Wade Major to hear what they think of the drama Kodachrome. Jason Sudeikis, Ed Harris, and Elizabeth Olsen star. Mike Rosso is the director and Jonathan Troper is the screenwriter. Christy?
So this is inspired by a New York Times article about the last place on Earth that would develop Kodachrome finally closing. And the flock of people and photography enthusiasts who wanted to get there before it happened. Among them in this film are Jason Sudeikis as a 30, 40-ish music executive who is estranged from his dad, who was this legendary photographer, played by Ed Harris. And Elizabeth Olsen is Ed Harris's nurse and companion and goes to Jason Sudeikis and says, look, your dad is dying. This is his dying wish to go and get these Kodachrome film roles developed once and for all. And it sounds totally formulaic. We were talking about I Feel Pretty and the formula that follows. This on paper is like every Sundance indie in which estranged relatives have to go on a road trip, not on highways, only on two-lane roads with the top down in the convertible. Like, you need a checklist. And Elizabeth Olsen, as the woman between them, is kind of like the manic pixie dream girl who always happens to have the right thing to say at the right time. But there's enough to each of these characters that is different enough. And there's enough that happens on their trip that is surprising enough that this is much more dramatic and much more engrossing than I would have expected at the outset.
Wait.
I concur. the one that it most resembles is Nebraska, in part because the son in both of those is a former SNL actor, Will Forte in Nebraska, and obviously Jason Sudeikis here. And then they went and got a great old classic actor to play the dad, Bruce Dern, Ed Harris. And but whereas Nebraska is obviously quirkier and has that Alexander Payne sensibility and goes into these weird tangential areas, this one really does kind of go right down the middle, and it sort of hits every beat that you would expect it to hit. But what Christy said is right. It's elevated by the fact that these actors are so good in their parts, and casting just saves this thing. Elizabeth Olsen fundamentally doesn't have anything unique to do here, but she's unbelievably good. She just takes a very threadbare role that's sort of all cliches and makes it something amazing. And she's a wonder to watch. And Ed Harris takes a crusty old, you know, pompous photographer who's never a good dad, never a good husband, one of those, right? And somehow you just can't take your eyes off of his face, the wrinkles, the beard, the hair, the eyes, those constrained tears. Ed Harris brings so much force to everything he does.
You don't sound that impressed with the screenplay, though. I was getting a sense from you, Christy, that you felt was better written.
It becomes so, yes. At the outset, it seems like we've been down this road before, literally. But Jason Sudeikis' character, too, is like the central figure in so many indies. Like, guy at a crossroads professionally and personally, and he has to reconnect to find what matters.
And he's always like a journalist or works in the movie business. Or always.
Why
you know,
is that?
Yeah.
Sudeikis has a little bit of the Will Ferrell problem, which is because we associate his face with, well, and it's the Jim Carrey problem, too, because his face is so associated with being kind of rubbery and comedic and very broad kinds of comedy. When they go dramatic, it's very hard to let go of that baggage. I've had a problem with him doing that in the past. Here, he sells it a lot better. So I was able to really buy him more. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that he's playing opposite Ed Harris.
And the music is good in this. Quite often the musical choices in this kind of film are super on the nose and obvious. And here they're a little more inspired, which also creates a sense of place with these people.
We're talking about Kodachrome, a drama that stars Jason Sudeikis, Ed Harris, Elizabeth Olsen, Mark Rosso, the director. It's unrated. You can see it at the Landmark Theater in West L.A., and it's also streaming now on Netflix. The documentary Grace Jones, Bloodlight and Bammy. Hard to believe you could make anything other than a great documentary about Grace Jones. She so lends herself to it. Sophie Fiennes is the director of it. Christy, what'd you think?
This is indeed a great documentary about Grace Jones. So you got what you were looking for. And she is so fascinating. And this is, it doesn't try to explain her. It doesn't try to understand her. It just basks in her fabulousness. And that's the smart thing to do. Just turn on the camera and let her be
Grace Jones.
But what's fascinating, one of the many things that are fascinating here, is which version of Grace Jones do we get from one moment to another? Because she's constantly performing. She's a performance artist, and life is a performance to her. So this movie bounces back and forth between her going back to Jamaica for a reunion with her family, where she's understated and, you know, not a lot of makeup, and she's got the Jamaican patois, and she's part of that rhythm of life there. But she's also in Paris, and she's performing, and she's recording an album, and there she's like the diva, and she's putting on some kind of fake French accent, and whoever she's talking to, sometimes there's a British accent, sometimes she's just hanging out smoking a joint and drinking champagne, and there's a whole other accent that comes out. And so who she's going to be from one moment to the next is fascinating, and intercut between them are the performances on stage, where she is just a force to be reckoned with. She's going to be 70 like any day now.
Her last show that she did in Los Angeles, I read the review of it, and it was an incredible rave. And apparently she did a large portion of it topless.
Because she can. Why not?
And that she was just so owned this. So charismatic.
Yeah.
It is such a wonderful movie. I want to give a lot of credit to Sophie Fiennes, who, by the way, is the sister of Rafe and Joseph Fiennes, who has always been a really fine filmmaker, but for some reason doesn't make a lot of movies on her own, just kind of, whenever she feels she wants to, which is a nice luxury. But she's such a tremendous filmmaker, especially narrative movies. But here she says, I'm just going to be a fly on the wall of Grace Jones's life. There's no reason for this performance artist to get any embellishment from me. She embellishes her own life. So I'm just going to point a camera at her, and I'm going to lurk in the background sometimes and see what I can capture. And it's a wonderful portrait. And, you know, you see Grace Jones, all nearly 70 years old of her, wearing a leotard, and you think, well, that's probably holding a few things in. There's a little support in there. Oh, no. Later in the film, Grace is walking around completely disrobed, and she gets a massage disrobed, and you realize this is a 70-year-old woman who has a physique that 20-year-olds would kill for. She's just a force of nature as a performer, as just a human being. And the contrast between Jamaica and Paris is interesting because that's family in both cases. Her son is Parisian, and her grandchild is in Paris, and she has family there, and she has family in Jamaica. And she is at ease in both countries, in both cultures, with both languages. She's just an extraordinary entertainment figure, and we just don't have the likes of her today.
She's her own creation. Grace Jones, Bloodlight and Bam. The documentary at the New Art Theater in West L.A. and in Irvine at the Edwards University Town Center. The documentary is unrated. Western, a German-Bulgarian drama that is written and directed by Valeska Griesbach. Christy, what do you think of Western?
This is going to sound like a tough sell when I describe it to you, but just trust me when I tell you that it's fascinating. Wade's already laughing at me. I love it. I get to describe Western. So it's about a group of German construction workers who go to a remote mountainous area in Bulgaria to do, it's like a water treatment plant that they're building there. And it's about the rhythms of their day-to-day life, and it's how increasingly they begin to interact with the people in the village nearby, which is totally insular, and people who have never left this place, and they're extremely suspicious of any kind of visitors. And you don't know from one moment to the next whether the interactions are going to be cordial or whether they're going to be fraught with tension. There's also a language barrier, and maybe one person speaks German in this town, or one person might speak a little bit of Bulgarian or Russian, and it's close enough. And it's so tense. It's a really slow burn. It's really understated. It has a really rich sense of place in this very hot, dry, sunny area. But you don't know what's going to happen, and that's what makes it fascinating. Also, the central figure here is they've got to all be non-actors, right? That Meinhard Newman, who's the central guy.
Whose name is Meinhard in the
who
film.
Who plays a guy named Meinhard. Easy enough. He's our conduit, and he bridges both of these worlds. And he's just got like this fantastic kind of like old-fashioned cowboy face and carriage to him. And I liked it, but I can imagine how it's not going to be everyone's cup of tea.
Wait.
She just pushed me right back over to liking it.
Hooray!
More again. I've gone back.
That's
and
influence, Chris. I'm impressed. Wow.
I've gone back and forth on this so many times. When I woke up this morning, I wasn't sure if I was going to say nice things or mean things. It has qualities from the Romanian style of filmmaking, the Hungarian-Romanian school, which I have loved and which I have hated. If it's a movie
hard
like
to be lukewarm about.
It's hard. I mean, if it's something like 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days, I love that film. If it's like The Death of Lazarescu, I you could just stick,
you didn't like that?
Couldn't stand it. Okay. Absolutely bored me to an ice cube. So. There's a lot of that in here, that very slow burn, as Christy said, and that can alienate you a little bit when characters are just kind of standing around and blinking at each other and not really doing anything and the camera's not doing anything. I get impatient, but you can pay it off and then I'm forgiving. So ultimately, I think it works. I think the faces, the fact that they're all non-actors, the fact that they just sort of immerse you in this culture and do create that tension really ultimately does pay off. But boy, there are some moments that were tough going for me.
Western is the German-Bulgarian drama we're talking about at Lemley's Music Hall, Beverly Hills. It's unrated. The French biographical comedy Godard, Mon Amour stars Louis Garrel and Stacey Martin, and the film is rated R. Wade, what'd you think?
I love this movie. Now, I am a fetishist for the films of Michel Hazanavicius, who, of course, directed and won the Oscar for The Artist some years ago. This is doing what he does well, which is, if you go all the way back to La Classe Américaine, which was his first film, which was, pieces of American movies all cut together with this dub track of a whole new storyline in French. He's a scholar of movie styles. He knows how to do this. And he's basically adapting a book by Godard's second wife, which is all about the period during which they were making La Chinoise, which she was the star of. And that's a pivotal period in Godard's career because he decided that he was going to lose his mind and become a revolutionary Maoist and disown everything that he had ever done and somehow try to reinvent movies as a political didactic, which is nuts. And the movies he made thereafter were insane. So this really is adapting her book as a way of poking fun at Godard and mocking this ridiculous pretension period of his life, which dovetails into something very significant in 1968 when he becomes part of the student revolution, the student protests in Paris, and they canceled the Cannes Film Festival, and he's trying to be down with the kids. And, of course, they think that he's just a big bourgeois, filmmaker.
Godard, Mon Amour. Christy?
I am not a giant fan of this film or of Michel Hazanavicius. this is an excellent example of what he does all the time, which is he's a talented mimic. And there's not a whole lot of insight here. And yeah, he copies Godard's signature visual style and his tricks in a lot of ways, including, the subtitles commenting on what the characters are actually saying and naked women just
being
bored.
And the direct address, looking to the camera.
Yeah,
he
does all that, but like to what end and for what point? And I did not, it was
not
empty,
for you.
Empty and vapid.
Godard, Mon Amour is rated R at Lemley's Royal Theater in West Los Angeles. Coming up, we're going to talk about a couple more films and talk with the president of the Screen Actors Guild, Gabrielle Carteris. We'll talk about a new code of conduct that affects producers, directors, and actors.
Hey,
Such pleasure to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. In just a couple minutes, we'll talk with the president of SAG-AFTRA, Gabriel Carteris, about the expansion of the Code of Conduct and specifically how that applies to auditions, of course, which have long been fraught in Hollywood. But first, a review of Lives Well Lived, a new documentary which takes a look at 40 people ages 75 to 100 to hear about their life experience and view of the world. Skye Bergman is the director. Wade, quick comment on Lives Well Lived.
Nothing novel in terms of the filmmaking, but in terms of the people in the movie, I think it's really quite fascinating. You're having wisdom imparted from people of all different races, nationalities, backgrounds, socioeconomic levels, as to what makes life worthwhile and how they keep themselves going in that latter half of life in your twilight years. And there's a lot of wisdom here. And as you get closer to that age, I think people will find a lot more to embrace.
Carl Reiner he was involved with a film that came out a few months ago that was very popular, similar, mm-hmm. Looking at people that were quite old. Christy, what did you think of the film?
It's very inspiring, very informative, a nice array of voices here. And it's a great reminder that everyone has a fascinating story to tell if you just take a moment and listen to it.
We're going to have a lot of people in their 90s and 100s, a huge bulge in the population. Lives Well Lived, documentary in selected theaters. It's unrated. And finally, the documentary The Judge, Erica Cohn is the director. Wade?
This is a really fascinating film. There's a lot of talk about Sharia law here, which is typically understood to be, really unbelievably draconian, militant religious courts in place with the Taliban or in Iran. The truth is there are Sharia courts all over the world, and in much of the Middle East and in Palestine, certainly, they fulfill a vital role along with the civil courts. You have primarily family law is determined in the Sharia courts, and between the Left Bank and Gaza Strip, there's this weird hodgepodge of traditions. Some are from the Ottomans, some are part of the Israeli legal system, and this woman, Khulood Al-Faqi, it became the very first woman to be a Sharia court judge in Palestine. And it's a fascinating glass ceiling that she broke. And the way that other judges react to this, the way that others in Islamic society in Palestine react to this, is really quite interesting. And it has continued to be a trend. There are more women who have followed in her footsteps.
Is she a good subject of a doc herself, or more the role that she took on?
Both. She's really quite a fascinating figure. And her life and her view on life and her view on law and religion is quite informative.
The film is The Judge. It's a documentary at Lemley's Monica Film Center, Santa Monica. Erica Cohn is the director, and it's unrated. We continue on Film Week looking at an expanded code of conduct from SAG-AFTRA, the Screen Actors Guild, looking at ways to try and deal with abuses in the casting process. And with us is the president of SAG-AFTRA, Gabriel Carteris. Thank you so much for being with us today on Film Week.
Thank you so much, Larry. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks.
Thank you for having me on, really.
Well, let's talk about the specifics of this. It urges no more auditions to be held in hotel rooms, private hotel rooms, and in people's houses. How common a practice is that in the film and TV biz?
Well, I think it's been a part of the practice probably from the very beginning, but it's a practice that we don't support. We actually, in our contracts, we have that as a part of our contract, but clearly that's not necessarily applying outside of our contracts. So we felt it was important to write a guideline that was clear, without any question, get that gray out. Boundaries have not been defined in the past, and we wanted to make sure that they were.
Is there a potential that low-budget productions could be hurt here, where maybe renting an audition space could be difficult? Or have you heard at all pushback on this?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing was we know that in low budget that they don't always have the money to rent out a space, but that's why we also have a support peer part of our guidelines. And the support peer is the aspect of nobody, just like in a doctor's office when you go for, a checkup, you're not alone in the room with the doctor. They always have somebody else with you. It's the same thing. If you go in, you can bring either a friend, family member, you can bring an agent, you can bring a fellow actor. It's just that there's no reason ever to be alone in a room with somebody when you're in the audition process or in the interview working on it. You don't do it as, you know, in any other field, actually. Nobody goes into a hotel room to show to do their business, and it's business.
Gabrielle, for you, have you ever been called in on auditions in that kind of circumstance, or at your level, is everything in a formal space to audition?
No, you know, I personally have not been asked to go into a hotel room, but I have been in situations where I am on location and I'm asked to go into a room that's where I'm the sole person there with the other person. And I feel that, you know, to have the power, it's so hard for people without having a guideline to be able to come in and say, look, this isn't comfortable for me. So if we give them that language and they can say, I'm glad to be with you, but it's part of our guidelines, SAG-AFTRA, that I can bring a support peer person in and I'd like to do that. It gives them freedom to actually be empowered.
We're talking with Gabrielle Carteras, who's the president of SAG-AFTRA. By the way of disclosure, I should mention I'm a member of SAG-AFTRA myself. I welcome your calls if you're listening live to Film Week Friday in the 11 o'clock hour. If you're an actor, if you're a producer, director, what do you think of these guidelines? Very explicitly laid out that auditions should not take place in private hotel rooms, nor should they take place in personal homes. And if they have to be in some sort of a setting like that, that every member should bring with him or her someone who is a trusted individual to be there, to be the third person in the room. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. I'm also curious, if you are an actor, would you have a hard time as an AirTalk listener, bringing an additional person with you? Do you feel that might hurt your chances of being cast? That would make you seem, you know, somehow you're more difficult or more demanding, or I don't know how you think it might be perceived. But I'd like to hear your response to this as a Film Week listener. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page. Gabrielle, have any actors said to you, hey, this is a great idea, but I worry if I did bring someone with me to the audition that would hurt my chances?
Oh, you know, it's so interesting when you said that just now, Larry. Nobody has said that to me. And I've talked to actors who are just starting off and to people who are very established. They actually say the idea that we'd have a standard set makes it so that nobody will feel compromised. If this is the thing that we all do, then nobody's being left out there to hang. It's the idea that that's really what's great about SAG-AFTRA. We are a collective, right? So if everybody makes this agreement together, then there's no discomfort. It's really when people feel like they just can't because nobody else is enforcing that. So this is an opportunity for people to really feel that they have a voice and a choice of how to work.
And I wonder if the Me Too movement has sort of primed this to happen, because now the public perception of taking additional caution and requiring certain, you know, professional standards for auditions, that now this isn't put in the difficult, quote-unquote, category, but the professional category.
Exactly. And this is a profession, right? This is a business. And in professional standards in any other business, you don't go into people's hotel rooms. It's just not part of business when you're going to do an interview. So I think that, yes, if we make, and this is by making professional standards and putting them forward, I think that it actually creates more comfort than discomfort.
We'll continue our conversation with the president of SAG-AFTRA, Gabrielle Carteras, and I welcome your calls with your thoughts. If you're an actor, director, producer, what about the expanded code of conduct from SAG-AFTRA for no auditions in private homes, in private hotel rooms? And if they have to be in a setting like that, that's non-public, that is a non-professional environment, that the person auditioning is able to bring someone, a trusted individual, along with them to be present as the audition proceeds. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Look forward to hearing your input on this. How do you think this expanded code of conduct is going to play out in the real world of professional auditions? I welcome your thoughts. We'll be back with more on Film Week here on 89.3 KPCC. We're talking about SAG-AFTRA's new expanded code of conduct for auditions, attempting to deal with, on the less serious end of it, discomfort on the part of actors in private, non-professional audition settings, up to very, very serious abuses that probably throughout the history of the film industry have been part of the audition process. The Code of Conduct expansion calling for a ban on producers, directors, and casting being done in private homes, in private hotel rooms, and if they have to be in a non-professional private setting that the actor is able to bring with him or her a trusted individual to be a buddy there on the scene to make sure that the conduct of that audition is thoroughly professional. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. I look forward to your joining us. I have to ask a quick technical question. Do we have listeners on the line? Because it's not displaying on my screen. So just let me know if you would when we have listeners ready to go. I see many people have called in. Gabrielle Carteris, who is the president of SAG-AFTRA, joining us. Gabrielle, what sort of enforcement methods does the union have available?
Before I even go, I'll talk to you about the enforcement.
Yeah.
We have several different things that are going on, but I just wanted to, just for the last thing you just said, because I was thinking about this when we were on the air break, is that, you know, what's really interesting is these guidelines not only protect the actor, but actually it goes both ways, right? We're flipping it. It protects the person who's interviewing. It actually puts everybody in a space of neutrality where they can really just do the work and not be concerned either way, right, of something happening. So, you know, we're trying to take away a power structure and create a real business environment. So I just wanted to put that out there. But in terms of what we have put in place right now, we have a 24-hour hotline that we've actually, where there's a live person that if somebody feels at risk at any time that they can call, and that's 844-SAFER-SET or 844-723-3778. And that's a reporting system that we have. We also have field reps that will go out on the set if something's happening right in that moment. If anybody feels that, I really want this to be out there for not just our members, I think anybody who's on set, but I can say if you are in a dangerous situation and you feel that something, I mean, it's really dangerous, immediately take action. It's really important to be able to stop, reflect on what's going on. If you need to leave that situation, then leave that situation. But if you're able to call, if it's something that you feel might be happening or you see something that's going to go on, you can go and call us at that number at 844-SAFER-SET. We can send a rep out. We could also help you with law enforcement. Don't forget, sexual harassment or any kind of harassment is illegal. So if something's going on where you feel at risk, call the law.
All right. And
that's the first thing. So, but what
we'll put that on, well, by the way, we'll put that on our Film Week segment page. So if anyone wasn't able to write it down, the number will be there.
Yeah.
And on the enforcement part of it?
So in the enforcement part of it, we have actually field reps who go out. In that moment, they can stop a situation from happening. Also, don't forget, it's the studios that are the employers. So we actually will go to the employers and say, you have a responsibility on this set. Something's taking place, and we have done this before. We interface with the studios and work with them to go and change what's going on. So we have enforcement right there on the time it happens. We have ways to we've been working. I'm with the not only are we working internally, we're working with a lot of industry partners, and one of them is the Kathleen Kennedy Commission. So working with Anita Hill and talking about industry-wide what kind of enforcement can we have. And we're looking at an industry-wide reporting system, which is really important. But regardless, as that's being developed internally, we're also working on a reporting system that's even different from the 24/7 call-in line. Something that gives people access and we're looking at all the ways of being able to do that so that they can report and be in the safest situation as possible.
Let's talk with Sylvia in Santa Monica joining us live on our Friday airing of Film Week. Sylvia, go right ahead, please.
Hi. So I do voiceover work, and when I, this was many, many years ago, I was actually contracted to do a voiceover at a private home, and my agent made sure to talk to the director, made sure to vet him, and he had to send all this information. Well, I drove all the way up to the Hollywood Hills to this quote-unquote private studio to do the job, and lo and behold, there was no job. When I got there, I was the only one there. There was no work. There was no studio. He said, I just want you to know that there's really no job, but I just think you're really cute, and I saw you at an audition, and,
You must have been furious.
I was terrified. I was terrified because I was the only one there. There was no cell phone signal at the time. There was no way for me to get out of there. I mean, he could have easily raped me. He could have, I mean.
Sylvia, we're short on time. Obviously, a traumatic experience for you. What do you think that these guidelines would make a difference? Do you think that it would have kept you out of being in that vulnerable position?
Absolutely. I think it's 100% time. I think the union has made a brilliant decision. I think that this is so much as an actor, you are vulnerable to begin with. This is a brilliant decision on the union's part to back us in that way. I'm so excited and very, very thankful that these guidelines have been put into place.
Sylvia, I appreciate it. Thank you so much. Stacy in Beverly Hills, quick comment, please. Very short on time.
Yes, I just need to say that I think it should be up to the company holding the audition to provide the third party. I feel like it shouldn't be up to me to bring a person to an audition. It's like really hard to do that.
Well, the problem might be, though, that you wouldn't necessarily have trust in the other individual the company would provide, right? Gabrielle, quick comment on the actor bringing the person versus the production company.
Stacey, for us, it's about really empowering the individual, the member, right? So when you go and have, if they were to bring somebody in and that person, what if they were a cohort working together and they might, we want the member to walk in to feel comfortable and safe. And we know for sure if they're picking the person who they're bringing in that they're going to have that ability. Otherwise, it makes it so that we don't really know who's in that room.
All right. BB Steve writes on the page, this is one of the first policies I've heard that will have an impact on at least the audition process. I think the policy needs to extend to all aspects of actors engaging with production management or other staff end to end. Many of the evil acts seem to occur during the production process, not just at an audition. That's BB Steve writing on the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Gabrielle Carteris, President SAG-AFTRA, thank you so much for joining us and talking about the expansion of the code of conduct. We appreciate it.
You are amazing, Larry. Thank you for getting this out there. It's important. Thank you for everybody who's involved. And we'll have more guidelines coming out so we can help to empower members and create safety on the sets and outside of the sets.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it. For our Film Week critics, Christy Lemire, Wade Major joining us this week, I'm Larry Mantle, and all of us inviting you to come to our next Film Week screening at the Theater at Ace Hotel in downtown Los Angeles, Saturday night, June 2nd at 7 o'clock, The Graduate 50th anniversary screening on the big screen. I've never even seen it on a big screen. I've only seen The Graduate on TV. I hope you'll come join me and have this very special experience with a post-film conversation. Reserved seats available kpcc.org/in-person. Have a great day.